welcome. I made a first of all, to atone for a senior moment yesterday. PPP. Who can't keep things like that in mind? Program price parity. Parity was the word I was looking for. When we're equating the incomes of the Bangladeshis with the Norways. Then I'd like to just go back to a little bit of geography. I was worried about running out of time, and I chose not to say a couple of things which I think are going to be crucial to our analysis of the political parties. And so, if I may, could we go back to these maps? I've got more copies of what I'm calling the textbook. Anybody in need? Will you distribute to people who are without one? And where you will find some maps. What I wanted to say, first of all, I wanted to focus a little bit more upon Norway in our geography lesson, and specifically this part of Norway, off the city, the port city of Stavanger, which is in here, which is the where the rich oil fields in the North Sea have been discovered. Stavanger is called the Galveston of Norway. The big oil companies are there, not least Statoil, Statsoil, which maybe doesn't quite rival Shell or BP, but is one of the biggies in the drilling of oil, and is incidentally owned 50% by the government and 50% by private investors compose its board of directors. Anyway, the oil, I must say, is being very carefully managed by the Norwegians, from what I can see. The endowment which has been created, even a Harvard should envy it, despite a 14% plunge in 1998, the endowment from the oil is up $380 billion in U.S. dollar at the present time. And the policies of Statoil are very similar to the policies of Harvard University or Luther Theological Seminary. Only approximately 4% of that yield may be used for infrastructure improvements. And I'm pretty sure I'm right here that no political party that we're going to be analyzing in the first part of this hour has stepped forward and said, this is our money, we want our taxes reduced, has tried to get at that bond. I think it is well understood across the political spectrum that this must be very carefully managed. But now just one other point about Norwegian geography. If we go here up to the very top, and though, of course, flat maps of a globe are distorted, if one goes all the way, almost up to the to the North Pole, one comes to the island Svalbard Island, S-V-A-L-B-A-R-D, probably better known as Spitsbergen, S-P-I-T-Z. B-E-R-G-E-N. Svalbard god awful bad real estate as it is for Norway, way up there in the Indian latitudes, is another potential treasure trove for Norway. It, coal has long been mined there. But now, more crucially to my point before I get back to Poli-Sci 101, to the east of Spitsbergen, huge reserves of natural gas have been discovered. The natural gas is estimated to have potential value to Norway that will far exceed the oil, which will in time, however careful the management, the oil will be gone. But the extracting of the natural gas in that Arctic climate is another issue, and it is not yet proven profitable to take it out. And I think that there will be, as a result of the BP episode on our side of the pond, even more care. But the potential again for Norway is not lost on the rest of Europe or the world. And no thanks, and to where we were last time. We were talking about the array of political parties, and again, I have used Norway. It's really quite typical. There are one or two more in Denmark that have been able to name a person or two to the parliament, but the seven parties in Norway are more or less representative of what we would see in the other nations. And I had talked about the narrow squeak in the last elections in Norway. 85 members of the 169-seat parliament required to organize a government and name a prime minister from the ranks. And what I'm going to call the leftist bloc, but labels are dangerous, and if you think leftist means a bunch of wobblies who are out there with revolutionary fervor, you kind of misunderstand. This is a sort of a rather benign middle-class leftism in the Labour Party. Labour then, by coaxing what I label the agrarians to come over from the right-hand side of the vertical line, was able to achieve a majority. But they have 86 when 85 is required, and anything can happen. I do not believe, I think that Jens Stoltenberg, the person from their caucus, serves as their prime minister, is well aware that his days could be numbered, that there could be further shifts. Labour's trump card at the present time is that they are, I think, leading the parade in opposition to membership in the European Union. They are well aware that in the Articles of the Union, any position in the public sector must be publicly posted across the Union. Thus, if the hospital up in the north at Hammerfest needs an X-ray technician, it goes into the, it goes online, and members of, and so Romanians and Greeks and Portuguese X-ray technicians may compete for that position. And in general, the Union, linguistic proficiency in the home nation is not a requirement, which has, again, in the law of unintended consequences, is, I think, accelerating the use of English. Are we going to have a monolingual continent in Europe as a result of it? But what the Labour Party is saying is that our responsibility is to the full employment of Norwegian citizens, and that that Bulgarian X-ray technician, who happened to have 14 years of experience and use of some kind of an MRI device and that sort of thing, extensive experience, is taking the job from a Norwegian, you understand the scenario. And of course, a lot of the citizenry are resonating to that. And it is another reason that I don't predict that Norway is going to swing, is going to decide to join the Union. It's a little bit more of a Norge for Norskis, kind of a provincialism there.
What's the position of the Progress Party?
What's
the kind of the political position of the Progress Party?
I've got to wait with that, or I'm gonna fall out of sequence. But we'll be there in about 20 minutes.
Fine.
Thanks.
So, I'm patient.
Yeah. Now, for the agrarians, who have represented, they have been the people who have owned the small and I might add highly subsidized farms in Norway, and people in small towns, etc. This move over to cozy up with labor, it's been a big one. But the agrarians have found their reasons to be very worried about membership in the Union. And all of life is a metaphor, I guess, in one way. And I must tell you about the metaphor of the cucumber. The regulation of a cucumber on a farm or garden in Norway. The regulations of the Union fill, huge bookshelves of, volumes come out every week with new regulations that have been enacted by the Parliament in Brussels. And in the regulations concerning agricultural products which may be exported in the Union, there was a paragraph that somebody spotted about cucumbers and the maximum amount of curvature that would be permitted in a cucumber before it could be put into the export market. Well, the power of that sort of thing. All across Norway, somebody got a hold of that. We are Norwegian. We don't want anybody telling us how much curvature there should be in our cucumber, and it just spread like wildfire. It's one of those quirky things that has made for an uneasy alliance between labor and the agrarians. But now let me bounce so that you understand the political profile better, over to the other side, asking you to keep in mind that labor has, until the 1980s, whether it be Norway or the other four Nordic countries, has been in control. The prime ministers have been laborites. Though in the 80s, going into the 90s, and now that has somewhat changed. And what I'm going to call the right, or what is called in the Nordic countries the bourgeois coalition, is over here. And the major party are, again, I didn't quite know what word to use in English. If I say conservatives, be careful, it isn't going to mean quite what conservative means in the United States. These are not people, this is not Tea Party land in the conservative party, but it is highly committed to the concept that the future of Norway depends upon the health of its business climate. And so, for example, to go back to the Union, the Conservative Party argues very forcefully that the future of Norwegian industry and its products depend upon ease of export into the Union. At the present time, Norway has to have its lawyers drafting copyright and intellectual property matters. It's financial people dealing with tariffs, whether purchasing from the union or selling to the union. And it is, the conservatives argue, immensely expensive. And I think that was the tipping point, if I may drift here a little bit, to the fact that ultimately Sweden and Denmark went into the union when their big firms, Ericsson mobile telephones in Sweden, Husqvarna in sewing machines in Sweden, Saab, Volvo, etc., Lego in Denmark, felt that the business would be threatened if they were outside the common regulations of manufacturing in the union. So the conservatives pulled in with 30 votes and had to do their level best when the smoke cleared in the last election to try to get to 85, and as it may look to you now, failed rather dismally. The conservatives could pretty well count on this party, and I haven't known quite what to call it in the way that we would use words. In Norway, it's called Kristelig Folkeparti, the Christian People's Party. But if you think of it as some sort of a born again right wing anti-stem cell, anti-single sex marriage, anti-abortion kind of party, you miss the point. I would call this a theologically a very, very thoughtful political party. It's newspaper, and most of these parties have their own daily newspapers. Tremendous reinforcement, creation of stickiness among their adherents do. The op-ed pages in Vårt Land, our nation, the party, the Christian People's Party, a very constant and thoughtful analysis about finding theological direction for public policy in that country. And thus, among many things that are of concern to them is the extent to which the Norwegians should contribute to humanitarian aid to third world nations, for example, where, and I don't have the exact statistics in my head, but where we might come in, if you can, trying to compare apples and apples here at about 1% the Nordic nations generally are something like 3 or 4% off the top of the Norwegian budget. That would be an important issue. The continuation of a rigorous program of religious instruction in the all schools are public, virtually all schools, continues, elementary and secondary, though it has shifted very much from once having been a kind of the Lutheran catechism sort of instruction to comparative religions. And but that would be a concern to keep their eye on that, the Christian People's Party. The maintenance and of the churches of Norway is a great concern. These are the treasure troves of the history of Norway, the churches and the graveyards, and the appropriation of the Ministry of Church and Education to that is very important. Christian People's Party is very mindful of the fact that Sweden has now divested its government from the state church of Sweden from the government, except that the government still contributes to maintenance to the capital budget of its state church parishes. But more of that on Friday when we talk in more depth about religion. Anyway, the Christian People's Party is here. And then the coalition picked up 11 more votes with a party that, again, I don't quite know how to best label it, but I guess liberals would say it. It's a rather a classic and interesting kind of political party. It would tend to draw as its members the intellectual elites, the media people, communications people generally. It's op-ed pages in Dog Blotted, the day's news is again very, very thoughtful and deep. But my observation is that the Liberal Party has never succeeded in getting many of its members into Parliament. That its platforms, and the platforms are clearly enunciated for each party, so that when you or I go to vote, we're not looking at who the individual is. We're looking at the platform. But that the Liberal Party is, I think, mushy and muddy in this regard. It's a sort of, yes, one who's been his career in faculty meetings, is what I would call it. And then on the one hand, and then on the other, it has not found a clear visionary statement of the nature of the EU is going to take away our jobs, or the agrarians are forever saying that the various ministries of the government now located in Oslo should be moved out to provincial cities, each one having one in order to invigorate the countryside of Norway. That's something you may agree with or you may not, but you can get a hold of it. But the Liberals are going to talk about more money for the arts and those kinds of things. But I think have not been able to play as crucial a role. And so when the smoke settled in the big election, in the last big election in Norway, 30 plus 10 is 40 plus 11.
51.
I'm sorry, it's 51. 51, which is a long haul from the 85 required for the conservative, for the bourgeois coalition to get its majority. And why, and now down here to your question, 41 of the new members of the current parliament are in something that perhaps 10, 12 years ago we would have said was a movement, a stirring political movement in the land, but not a formalized party. But it is in evolution to formalization, and I'm going to use the word progress, a kind of a translation of their word. And it is what I think I referred to in your textbook as the 800-pound gorilla in the living room that no one quite knows how to talk about. The Progress Party has made immense inroads, especially with well-educated younger people, what I'm going to call your MBA types, etc., with a platform which is rather anti-immigrant.
Rather anti-what?
There it got said.
Immigrant.
Real reservations about immigration, which is the major topic for today, and real reservations about the tax levels. And you would, now you might think offhand, this is a maiden's prayer for the bourgeois coalition to open their arms to the Progress Party and assure themselves a heady majority. But there's a lot of fear of this Progress Party. If you you tap sentiment up here, it is not, I think, anti-tax. It is heavily, are our taxes being used wise, as wisely as they should be? The Conservative Party is not likely to respond to an anti-immigrant population. The Conservative Party is saying things like, look, the projections are, the facts and the projections are very clear. The number of infants born to women of childbearing age, obviously, is now around 1.3 for those mothers on the average. And it takes about 2.3 to even sustain a population. And though no one wants to say this publicly, that the immigrant, I mean, no one wants to say that they're brute souls or something, but the immigrant populations are probably the only hope for assuring demographic health for the future of Norway. For no one, I think, would be so naive as to think that post-modern societies like the Nordic countries, which have educated their women into the majorities of positions of physician, dentist, pharmacist, and I think in many fields of engineering, et cetera, are going to find that those women are willing to produce 2.3 children or more. So there's worry. Add to that on the bourgeois coalition side, postmodern societies require service workers. Who is going to care for the elderly on the night shift? When they are in terminal care, who's going to swab the urinals in the central rail station? Who's going to wash the dishes in the great restaurants on Strøget, the boulevard in Copenhagen, on and on? But again, that one has to be very, very careful about making that a public utterance. But it ain't going to be the Nordics, is it, who are going to line up for those jobs any more than we are finding in the United States. And so the Progress Party is a scary phenomenon. Maybe it's a blip. These 41, I think in the last parliament, I don't have it quite in my head, there were 20-some. But if it's a trend, there's going to have to be shifting and wooing. Now, are there things I could clarify about the parties and this very precarious but not unknown balance? I think in all the Nordic countries, the ruling coalition has a tiny but not majority.
I have a question up here.
Yes.
Up above. I'm up here in the balcony.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Is the handwriting on the wall at all for the Progress Party?
I'm glad you mentioned that. Not to my knowledge in Finland or Iceland, and maybe in part, I may be oversimplifying it, because Finland, and certainly not Iceland, have not become destination countries for migrants. But in Denmark, their version of the Progress Party single-handedly got the majority and organized the last parliament and named a very colorful young prime minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, and they set out with some glee to dismantle many features of Danish society. But two things happened. Fogh Rasmussen, in some order, failed to get a vote of confidence gambling that if he could increase the margin, he'd strengthen his hand, but he lost his bet and he failed to get that. And so, though he, again, he didn't go out on the street as in American politics, he just went back to his seat in the parliament, but he very quickly was hired by NATO to a top position. So Denmark actually organized the government around anti-tax, anti-immigrant sentiment. And Sweden is not as, it is not as powerful as it is in Norway, but it's 3 + 3 + 1. Incidentally, when you get home, keep your eye on the online reports or the newspaper. Sweden has has its big election in September, over a weekend in September, and there, as you have met the prime ministers on page 6 of your textbook, Fredrik Reinfeldt and the bourgeois coalition there feel somewhat imperiled. There could be a shift to a labor government. Does this show to you? I can tilt it, but before we get into the immigrant policy issues, can you read this from where you are? I thought before I evacuate from history in Northern, I asked myself the question, who in the history of Nordic politics will be most likely to be remembered? Who made the greatest impressions? And this is a difficult list, but a few names you should know. Last time we talked about the grand old man of heads of state across the world, Urho Kekkonen, who was for 27 years, I think, the president of Finland. So we've talked about him. But I think you want to meet the president of Iceland for about 18 years in the 1970s and 80s, the first democratically elected woman to be head of state. Golda Meir and Margaret Thatcher were surely democratically elected, but they were prime ministers. They were heads of government. Vigdis, as she, Finnbog's daughter, whose brother would have been Geir Finnbogsson, had what was extremely vigorous in the advancement the Icelandic economy. The Iceland Air, which now has, I think, 8 hubs in North America and maybe 8 more in Europe, runs a neat little airline, has an enormous expenditure for the government of Iceland, but had the full backing and encouragement of Vigdis, who now is a pooba in the World Health Organization in the United Nations. But she is remembered fondly, and she probably doesn't wish herself back to Iceland in view of their financial debacle. I think that history will remember the Swedish prime minister in the Labour Party in the 60s into the 70s, Olaf Palme. Sort of coterminous with the Vietnam War period. Olaf Palme was a very young prime minister. He had been one of the beneficiaries of Fulbright or one of the programs, and had as an undergraduate studied at Kenyon College in Ohio. I find this placement of students and faculty from abroad or the movement of our people to other countries to be such important keys to the future of international relations. And where I think most was his early on and vigorous opposition to American participation in the Vietnam War. Every speech and proclamation from the Prime Minister of Sweden was a thorn in the flesh of Richard Nixon, for example, who, incidentally, and you may think that this is that talking about the cucumber or this is not all that important, but what the Swedish press and the Nordic press never gave up on was the fact that when, at the height of this, Palme announced that he wished to make a state visit to the United States because he wanted to speak to the American Congress about the feelings in a very peace-oriented, or I should say diplomacy-oriented nation like Sweden. Richard Nixon did not meet him, and in the protocols of heads of government and heads of state, you do throw up the welcome mat, I sometimes think that was kind of the final straw for the United States image, which had historically been so great, so powerful, these are short vignettes. Palme was tragically assassinated in a nation of peace. He and his wife coming out of a movie theater in downtown Stockholm. The assailant has never been identified. It was not that long after the assassination of John Kennedy. And I think again, metaphorically, there were bonds. Understanding it was a shocking thing for Sweden. And I've often wondered what Palme's future might have been. I think it would have been a very powerful one. You didn't push that guy around, that's for sure. And then I chose, I'm going to go back to what I think would be called the generation of the grand old men. And I chose two of them, Einar Gerhardsen, the Prime Minister of Norway, the end of World War II. He had been in a German concentration camp during the war, he was prime minister for, I'm going to say, 15, 18 years. And his close associate, Tage Erlander, in Sweden for about the same time. They were not only Labour Party, but they both were Labour Party left. Now, on the left side, there's no question about that. The Labour Party, in that period, the development of those nations, was dealing with the issues of a high percentage of the labour force, which were in extracted industry employment. They worked on the fishing fleets. They worked as miners. In Sweden, in the woods, on the farms, etc., and the Labour Party had a powerful agenda that the bourgeoisie in Stockholm or in Oslo and Copenhagen had not been responsive, which is to say that when Gerhardsen or Erlander or their Danish colleague went to the congresses of the heads of government in Europe in the late 1940s and 50s, they held their own with Bevin of Great Britain, of Willy Brandt in Germany and so forth, and they were on the left side, they very much so, that government should be actively involved in the management of the means of production and the distribution of services, and that income levels between the bourgeoisie elites and the workers should be narrowed. They were tigers. They were, again, I would have to say, in the annals of the labor movement, they are among the Grand Old Myth. So just a few names for you to add to what you have in the textbook. And with that, I'd like to go now to what I've called an immigrant nations become immigrant nations. I guess when I first started teaching Scandinavian, we then said Scandinavian public policy back with the college in the 1960s, what I tossed out was the history of the emigration to America from those countries, the Finns who flowed into the Upper Peninsula, the Norwegians into Brooklyn and Ballard and the River Valley and so forth and on. But that was then, and this is now, and we have not been, we have not had immigrants. The occupation of the immigration and naturalization services of the Nordic countries is just that, serving huge immigrant populations. And I've talked a little too much. I'm trying to keep some parity between the countries about Norway. I'd like to, again, use kind of a case study method here and talk about the goings-on in Sweden after World War II in regard to the policy for immigrants. The Swedish civil service, the Nordic civil services are elites educationally. They are dominated by people who went to the universities like Uppsala and Lund and in Sweden and Helsinki in Finland, and they have connections all the way through the governments. And they knew, my goodness, they knew in the 1930s 1940s, and now I'm going to focus in on Sweden, that the country was in peril given fertility rates. It was perfectly clear that women were not, that contracepting was very efficient. And so even before the war, there was a great deal, there were very many social planning blueprints that the only future for Sweden would be a clear and a robust policy of encouraging immigration to Sweden. And it was guided, and though it all went on hold during World War II, of course, and took a little while after the war before it could be activated, it was based upon this fundamental principle that the worst thing that could happen for Sweden would be if it developed immigration policies such as there were emerging on the continent of Europe, particularly in the German-speaking nations. There is that charming word in the German language, the Gastarbeiter, you know, the guest workers, who were hardly guests, but they sure as heck were workers, but who could not ever get citizenship in the countries in which they came to work. They, when Siemens or Philips in Holland or Volkswagen needed workers, they posted ads in the Turkish and Yugoslavian press, for example, Volkswagen hiring, no. But those workers who needed work came in with only a labor visa. And the minute Volkswagen, for example, in terms of its profitability, needed layoffs, it was absolutely, there was no choice but that the workers had to go back home. Yes, sir.
So they're allowed to come in and work, they're paid, but they don't have the benefit of the United Tax Health? Are they allowed health benefits? Since they haven't been given citizenship,
How does that
in
work?
In general, yes. The healthcare on we're speaking of on the continent now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the children received schooling, and there are nuances here,
mm-hmm.
obviously, but in general, yes. But on the issue to go to Sweden, the planner said, we intend that these people become fully assimilated Swedish citizens. And the another precept of the immigration policy was that it be a labor force immigration, as it was, you know, workers were needed. Again, one had to be very delicate in how this was phrased, but in terms of service workers and assembly line workers, firms like Saab and Volvo were going great guns, but on an assembly line principle where you can't have people absent along the line, that kind of thing. And so, essentially, three countries were targeted. Turkey, which if you will call Turkey Europe, is the largest, and you don't call Russia Europe. Turkey is the largest in both area and population. So Turkey and the Yugoslav entity is dissolving, but some of its components, like Serbia, notably Serbia and Croatia, and then Greece, for the immigrants to come to Sweden. And the Swedish Immigration and Labor Offices opened offices in, for example, Ankara, in Belgrade, they weren't targeting the capital cities like Athens, but Salonika, for example, in Greece. And their Turkish or Serbo-Croatian or Greek-speaking immigration workers had offices, and when people came in, responded to the Sweden welcomes you banner, those workers were able, now you think of the money that this cost, but the workers could show them, for example, pictures of the flats in Sweden where they would be housed. They didn't probably spell this out very much, but that again was a tool of an elite civil service public policy group. They were determined not to repeat the American experience of barrios and ghettos, little Polands and that kind of thing. And the Agrarian Party was very much behind this, so that the incoming workers would be in, there would be 10, 12, 16 in Uddevalla and 18 more in Haparanda, but it worked pretty well for a time because there was a shortage of housing anyway, especially in Stockholm. So they could show the worker where they would be living. They could show the applicant for immigration the picture of the school, and for all I know, the school teacher that the children would have. And they could, they had all the materials in foreign language, in the indigenous language, and that sort of thing. And so there was a flow into a nation which, except for Finns who were forever crossing the Gulf of Bothnia for employment in Sweden, it had been very, very homogeneous, really. There was a huge flow into Norway. I had a winter for which I am forever grateful. One could compete then in the U.S. for John F. Kennedy fellowships. When Kennedy was assassinated, the school children of Sweden brought their nickels and dimes, and a fund was created which supported many of us for short-term research projects. And there was an unbelievable government organization, and it's Stockholm called the Svenska Institute, the Swedish Institute, which we had a sponsor, and I had the opportunity, because my application was to study the labor force immigrants, as they were called. I lived with a bunch of young Turkish guys. That's when I became an anti-smoker, I might add, for a few weeks in a dreary suburb of Stockholm, and to live with crazy Croatians in another town, and Greeks out in a textile town and on the western side of Norway, etc. It is very meaningful to me. And incidentally, I learned a social science research technique that maybe is a rationalization, but I think I gained rapport with those guys. I use the term advisedly because their Swedish was so much better than mine, and they just cracked up at all my mistakes, and they said, PhD. And, but they were very proud, too. But I sometimes felt I had words they didn't have, but they had communication skills that I would never have. But somehow we teamed, and I was able to get a lot of interviews and that kind of thing. Each of the immigrant streams is a different story. The Turks, when Sweden's determination to make of these people citizens was very accepted by the Turks. They had died and gone to heaven, in a sense. And I don't know how many times they told me how proud they were. They had some job cleaning, doing dishes in restaurants, but that they were sending home more money to their families than their fathers earned in a year, in a month, you know, than their fathers earned for a year. They were highly susceptible to full assimilation. It's to get ahead of my story, the Swedes, who may not have been highly susceptible to the accepting of the Turks at the level that the Turks would have wanted. The Serbs and the Croatians, they speak a common language, Serbo-Croatian, are a somewhat different story because of Greek suspicion within their own ranks. Of course, the enmities have been eternal there between the Orthodox Christian Serbians and the Roman Catholic Croatians. And I might have added the Muslim Bosnians were also coming in. So they were afraid to talk with one another. They didn't know where they stood. And the Croatians had a terrorist movement within their own ranks called the Ustasa, U-S-T-A-S-A, which was blowing up cars and mailboxes and that kind of thing. So they were walking on eggshells, in a sense. The Greeks were sort of a calamity in terms of susceptibility to Swedish citizenship. They said, all right, we're here. We're better off economically than in the dreary northern provinces of Greece, but why are we learning Swedish? We speak. And so they wasted no time sending their children back to Greece to live with their grandparents, to get a Greek education, etc. But now to get to some of the public policy questions, which I hope fit into the, are these gardens of Eden or nanny nations, that took off in Sweden in the 1970s were sort of the heyday. To go back to language, the Swedish authorities felt that it was absolutely essential that all immigrants learn to speak Swedish. And here are just a few of the accommodations that were made. In every principal employer plant or officer agency, etc. The workers from the immigrant countries were entitled to, let's call it SSL, Swedish as a second language, instruction well on the job. On the line at Saab, you hear a bell tinkle, and it means that Serbo-Croatian people now go to their tutor, that sort of thing. And who left the line, which again, to get into industrial production, is immensely complicated for management, and have their, let's say, hour a day of instruction. For women who were at home, neighborhood centers were created and funded by the Swedish government where they could have, companionship, but classes like SSL, which they were expected to attend. And for the children, the educational issues were just prodigious. What I call the ed psych industry within the Ministry of Education argued vigorously that you cannot expect of children that they can, you cannot cut them off from their mother tongue in the cognitive areas, but you can do so in the more non-cognitive fields, which is jargon for saying that they had a plan, and you just start calculating the cost of this. Remember I said there were only 24 Turks in Haparanda, something like this, where in first grade, the instruction in language arts and whatever it's called, social studies or that sort of thing, highly cognitive, would be in Turkish. In second grade, that 100% dosage, the textbook materials would be reduced to, let's say, 80% Turkish and 20% Swedish, and so that by approximately sixth grade, the child was entirely educated in Swedish. At the same time, in art, in music, in home economics or whatever these things are called, the instruction was in Swedish from the get-go. And, to find teachers, Turkish teachers, and Serbo-Croatian speaking teachers was absolutely daunting. And of course, it reduced the Swedish government to having to try to buy into a brain drain from the countries from which they were seeking immigrants. And to enlisting all kinds of people who weren't what we would call licensed or certified teachers, spouses of workers from that country, to teaching the children. But I mention all of this because in public policy, of course, we have many who argue in public policy that there be one language, English, from the get-go, and I'd like to keep that in mind. Let me use as other examples. I mentioned that the Swedish government provided, I'll call them community houses for the immigrants of each nationality, and they where they could meet safely and. And it was interesting, and it was so very Swedish that the stipulation for the immigrant groups was you may have an organizational meeting space, but you must develop a constitution and bylaws for your organization, which ensure that this is equal opportunity and affirmative action and open to both genders. Yeah, Andy?
Yeah, at the risk of just way oversimplification, did it work?
Mixed bag. I think for the Greeks, it sure didn't. I think it was an
sort of follow, but then what about the second, third generation? Just, you know, contrasting, say, with the American approach, which they sort of said, kind of use a pejorative ario, but actually, in some respects, having immigrant cultures together, they're able to loan each other money, start businesses, get a foothold, and then they tend to move beyond that enclave and into the more general society. Whereas this one looks like, wow, they're sort of saying, listen, we're going to absorb these guys really quick. But it seems like some modern Europe's having real problems with the second and third generations because it wasn't sort of a natural evolution into this. It was sort of this highly engineered approach of assimilation. And, you know, you're looking at France now, for example, and I don't know how it compares to this. They're having a lot of immigration issue, and it seems like progress, their immigration issues seem to have a more immediacy even than our immigration issues. We kind of focus on sort of the Southwest, and it's primarily the Southwest. So, anyway, any thoughts on that?
I sure will.
Sure. Sorry.
Let me just say, as an overview, these were the labor force immigrants of the 1960s. The Serbo-Croatians and the Turks, now those who came, our grandparents, if alive, and intermarriage with Swedes has occurred, and I would say so. I would say far better than countries like France, where the immigrant populations are in slums, the suburbs of every major French city, that kind of thing, but all amplified. Let's see, forgive me. What was I? I forget just where I. And this gets to your point again. The neighborhood house concept, and the Greeks, I was living with Greeks at the time, they said, Dave, Volovit, they said, these Swedes are such idiots. They're so naive. We understand the drill. We understand the game. Sure. We passed the Constitution. It said men and women equal membership rights and services, et cetera, but we didn't really mean that. Their places became coffee houses for Greek men, no different than what Salonika had provided. But I'm trying to say here is that the commitment to the funding of assimilation is, I think, a case study in immigration that we've not really seen in on any scale like this, and to my knowledge in the world. Let me go on with just another example or two of what went on in the 60s, in which I saw and even participated in to a degree. When that immigrant family from Anatolian Turkey, whom I spoke of before, where there had been a worker in Turkey to show them the ropes before they got there. When they arrived, they had a business card, for example, for their contact person. And I did many interviews that will forever be in my mind. A young Croatian mother told me, for example, how wonderful but how confused it was for her. She went to her intake worker in Malmo in Sweden when she arrived, and the worker was, you know, social work graciousness, you might say, and out comes a tea cart, you know, with a red rose and a vase on the tea cart and that kind of thing, and coffee and pastry, and the Serbian woman, the light goes on her head, food is being offered. The ultimate, you know, a sign of great acceptance in her home area. they have a second appointment, and the Serbian mother said, and so I made goulash or kolaches or whatever you made, and because food is the coin of the realm in relationships. It's hospitality and reciprocity, and the intake worker told me, and when I queried her about this case, she said, I thought I had seen it all and knew how to handle my job, but I didn't know what to do. She said, I'm a professional person, you can't accept them. Because in Sweden, you would never bring gifts or cookies or something like that to your, you know, to a person with whom you have a professional relationship. And the worker, I made too much of this, but said, to my great regret, I told her I could not accept that. She said, in retrospect, I should have accepted and dumped it or something, but, you know, ethics are always in shades of gray. Just a couple of other examples. I'm sorry. The witching hour. I'll pick this up next time and then want to go into child welfare policy and